WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's holiday edition of Fresh Air, singer and guitarist Bonnie Raitt talks about her life and plays us some of the blues recordings that most influenced her own development. And we hear from another performer who influenced her career, her father, John Raitt, a former Broadway star. They recently collaborated on a CD of show tunes. Bonnie Raitt and John Raitt coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. In celebration of Labor Day, Labor Secretary Robert Reich is out honoring employees who are working this holiday. He's in New York meeting with transport workers, and then he flies to Washington to meet with hospital workers.
Labor Day is a day that we really ought to remember the workers who are often the forgotten workers in America, the people who empty the bedpans and who mop the floors and sew the garments and who answer the telephones and do the kind of hard, grueling, and almost invisible work that many others of us take for granted, and especially those who are working on Labor Day.
Labor Secretary Robert Reich. Hurricane Edward has begun moving away from southern New England. Forecasters say the storm has turned northeasterly toward Nova Scotia. The sustained winds have been downgraded to 75 miles per hour, which are barely hurricane strength. Edward is centered about 115 miles east of Nantucket Island, Massachusetts. The storm has caused problems on Nantucket and Cape Cod. Paul Leary of Pembroke, Massachusetts, traveled to Cape Cod to get a firsthand look at Edward's effects.
Bit of a weather buff, thought I'd take a drive down to Chatham and figured that was the place to be to see the storm. A lot of debris down, some power lines down, and a few people walking around crazy like us.
The hurricane warning for southeastern Massachusetts has been downgraded to a tropical storm warning. All other watches and warnings for the United States have ended. Russia's National Security Advisor Alexander Lebed today meets with Prime Minister Viktor Chernomyrdin. Last week, Lebed signed a peace accord with Chechen rebels, which delays any discussion of Chechen independence for 5 years. The BBC's Andrew Harding reports from Moscow.
Alexander Lebed has made peace with the Chechen rebels. Now he needs to convince a skeptical Kremlin to go along with the deal. His meeting today with the Russian Prime Minister Viktor Chernomyrdin was the first test, and it seems to have gone well. According to Mr. Lebed's office, the Prime Minister voiced his support for the peace agreement, which was signed by Mr. Lebed and the Chechen military commander Aslan Maskhadov on Friday night. There had been some concern that Mr. Lebed had made changes to the document without the Kremlin's approval, but Mr. Chernomyrdin is now reported to have gone along with them. Alexander Lebed has often warned that his attempts to end the 20-month war in Chechnya could be sabotaged by his political enemies in Moscow. President Yeltsin's silence during this whole period has done little to ease the tension.
Andrew Harding reporting. Iranian state radio says the United States has delivered a warning to Kurds in northern Iraq by failing to help them against an Iraqi attack in Erbil. The Iranian report says Washington's efforts to mediate between rival Kurdish factions in Iraq failed. The stock markets are closed today. This is NPR. The U.S. chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is meeting in Jordan to discuss Iraq's military moves. General John Shalikashvili has already met with Saudi Arabian officials. Saudi sources say General Shalikashvili won Saudi help in any measures to punish Iraq for its strike against a Kurdish group over the weekend. The general meets today with Jordan's King Hussein, but the Jordanian government says it will not participate in any military operation against Iraq. Israeli and Palestinian officials have been holding marathon talks to arrange the first face-to-face meeting between Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. Observers suggest such an encounter is likely. Lori Neff reports.
Negotiations aimed at nailing down terms for the landmark meeting continued into the early hours of the morning. Israeli Foreign Minister David Levy says the encounter could take place by week's end. However, Palestinians say several issues remain unresolved, such as gaining an Israeli commitment to implement previous agreements, including an Israeli troop redeployment in the West Bank town of Hebron. Meanwhile, Netanyahu, who has so far resisted meeting Arafat, has given his strongest indication yet that he would do so. The prime minister softened his line amid calls for such a meeting by senior members of his own government and Palestinian warnings of a possible resumption of the six-year-long Palestinian uprising that ended in 1993. For National Public Radio, I'm Lori Neff in Jerusalem.
Wildfires continue to burn today in seven western states. The blazes have scorched some 720,000 acres so far. Some of the worst blazes have been in Nevada, where four fires are still uncontained. Meanwhile, officials expect a blaze in Yellowstone National Park, Wyoming, to burn out of the park. That fire was started by lightning last June. Authorities say major fires in California should be fully contained today or tomorrow, and firefighters in Oregon are hoping for rain. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this Labor Day, we celebrate some great American music with singer and guitarist Bunny Raitt. Throughout her career, Bunny Raitt has paid tribute to the blues and R&B performers who most influenced her. Some of them perform with her on her latest album, Road Tested. Earlier this year, we invited Bunny Raitt to play us some of the blues recordings that most influenced her own development as a singer and guitarist. Before we hear those recordings, let's listen to a blues from her first album, which was released in 1971. This is Bunny Raitt performing the Robert Johnson song, Walking Blues.
Woke up this morning, I'm feeling around to my shoes. You know about that, I must have had them walking blues. Woke up this morning, people, I'm feeling around to my shoes. Well, you know by that I must have had them walking blues.
Bunny Raitt, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi, Terry. It's a pleasure to be here.
You've brought with you some of your favorite recordings, some of the recordings that have really influenced you over the years. So I'd like to start with a recording that you brought by Mississippi Fred McDowell. Write me a few lines. Tell me why you've chosen this. This was recorded in 1964.
Well, I did because I've been performing that song, Write Me a Few of Your Lines, as well as his Kokomo Blues, probably since the first time I met Fred. I was about 19 in 1969, and he was part of the great blues rediscovery in the 60s of all these traditional Delta bluesmen who a lot of times, like Fred, had spent the last 20 years being farmers and then suddenly were discovered by either British or white college kids coming over that just fell in love. And I got his record on our Hooli Records and learned the song, and then I was honored enough to meet him and travel around with him, and I actually opened a lot of shows for him early on when I was still cutting my teeth and right before I got my first record deal. So he's really my favorite and my closest friend, and I miss him a lot and wanted people to know that when they hear my version on the live album, for example, that this is where we got it, the great Mississippi Fred McDowell.
Oh, let's hear it, recorded in 1964.
Lord, when you get home, baby, please write me a few of your lines. Mm-hmm. that I be consolation. Lord, mama, to my worried mind.
That's Mississippi Fred McDowell, one of the records that Bonnie Raitt has brought with her today for us to listen to. Now, what was it like when you were actually traveling with him and opening for him? Was that one of the first times that you met one of the blues musicians who you liked so much from record?
Actually, I started out with the father of Delta Blues. I'm making an appearance in Cambridge at the house of a man who helped rediscover him, Dick Waterman, who came to be a very important part of my life and a lot of the lives of blues people. Son House was staying with Dick Waterman in Cambridge, where I was going to college, and I heard through the Harvard radio station that he was going to be there, and this other blues fanatic, a friend of mine, said, would you like to meet him? So it started with that, and then I met Dick Waterman that day and went on to get to hang out with Skip James and Big Boy Arthur Crudup and Fred McDowell and Mance Lipscomb, and then Buddy Guy, Junior Wells were all people that Dick booked, and he had worked with Mississippi John Hurt, who unfortunately had passed away before I got a chance to meet him. But that was my entry into meeting all these great blues people, and part of the reason I took a semester off in my sophomore year was because I knew that these guys were up in age and that I wasn't going to have this opportunity to kind of get to know them and learn at their feet and be of service or just hang out and get and soak this up. And that was when Fred and I just made this bond, and I'm sure he, as well as the other bluesmen, always got a big kick out of the fact that this little round-faced redhead was playing Robert Johnson songs and Son House songs, and I just sat there listening to their stories and learned to drink and, you know, try to be a blues woman at 20, which, you know, I managed to do by the time I was 40 and get recognized for it. But, you know, I worked at it pretty hard there in the early days.
Were you overwhelmed when you were 20 by the incredible differences between, you know, in age, race, gender, class, between you and the older blues musicians who you were understudying?
You know, I'm sure it was odd from the outside, but from the inside, most of the people that were in love with blues were white middle-class kids that were just, you know, going to folk festivals and going around the South with tape recorders. And, of course, the British interest in the blues and Big Bill Brunsey and Leadbelly, and that led to so many of these records being exposed to groups that became the Rolling Stones and the Animals and the Beatles even. You know, the rhythm and blues music was on the radio at that time. Not Delta Blues, but Rhythm and Blues was on the radio right next to the Beatles and all the white groups. So it wasn't as segregated, and it didn't seem as culturally odd to me at the time. I just knew that I'd lucked into something.
You know, sometimes when a man is interested in another man's music, that it's understood to be an interest in music, but when a woman is interested in a man's music, it's sometimes understood to be flirtatious or something sexual. Do you know what I mean? Did people ever misunderstand your interest in their music?
No, not really. I mean, Fred at one point was staying overnight at my mom's house. My folks had been divorced at that point, and outside of New York, and I heard him like creeping across the hall in the middle of the night. And I got up and I said, "Hey, Fred, where are you going?" And he said, "Well, you know, I thought your mother might be lonely," which just killed me because I think he thought my mom was really cute. But they never, you know, they never really crossed the boundary. I think the age difference probably made. And my total adoration was more of a daughter thing, I think.
Now, on your latest album, your live album, you do a tribute to Fred McDowell. You play part of Write Me a Few of Your Lines, which we just heard. This is your Kokomo medley. Did you learn things from Fred McDowell on your guitar playing or your approach to that song that you're still using today that you could describe for us?
Well, his particular, you know, my style is obviously a little different, and of course the key's different because I sing in a woman's key. There were some chords that he used, you know, certain positions on the guitar that I wouldn't have been able to figure out because until I watched him do it. But the basic way you learn guitar for me, because I didn't take lessons, was just listening and mimicking. And his soulfulness on and just his abandon, the way he got into it. And when he played electric guitar, which he did a lot of the time in later years because it cut through more to clubs where kids were noisy. And, you know, that's what led me to the electric guitar, was the way that the note would sustain and just sing, and the way you could just, it's so funky when you get these, you know, cheap amps, and, you know, it's just, you know, that's the stuff that makes David Lindley and Ry Cooder Jackson Browne's slide plan so great because they just use these really incredible amplification that duplicates the old, really inexpensive amps. And people want to know how to get that funky sound. Well, get a $25 guitar and the cheapest amp you can find.
Well, let's hear your tribute to Fred McDowell, the Kokomo Medley from your latest album, Road Tested. Bonnie Raitt. Bonnie Raitt is my guest. Now, did he show you that opening riff?
No, I just heard it. You know, it's not that difficult to play. It's just one of the, whenever you're learning a song from somebody else, you don't really have to see it because you can just, unless you're playing some kind of amazing Jimi Hendrix thing, and which I probably wouldn't even be able to tackle. These things that I play are really stuff that I can manage. It's the finesse of it and the soul that you put into it that makes him different from me, probably. And hopefully one day I'll get to be as funky as he is.
Now, I know when you were starting out, you were listening to folk music as well as to blues. Now, women's voices in folk music at the time were kind of like clear, bell-like soprano voices. I'm thinking of, you know, Joan Baez, Judy Collins. Mm. And in blues, of course, it's a much kind of rougher voice that blues singers use. And I was wondering if you have a beautiful, clear voice. I was wondering if you try to also develop a gruffer voice for the blues.
Oh, yeah. Singer. I mean, I thought if I just drank Jim Beam and hung out with those guys and stayed up too late, and I couldn't stand the way I sounded when I was singing blues tunes. It just sounded the fruitiest, you know, whitest voice I'd ever heard, which I didn't mind singing Joan Baez songs. But, and I really did think that if I just lived that, you know, I went from being pretty much not a rebel rouser as a teenager. I was a really good student. I went away to a Quaker school and went right to college, and I don't even think I partied at all until I was about 20, and the drinking age in Massachusetts wasn't even until 21. So I started hanging out with these hardcore guys, and, you know, like any kid sitting at the feet of the masters, you know, I also got to go on tour hanging out with Buddy and Junior's band on the Rolling Stones tour of Europe, so that was some professional hound dogs there. So, you know, those first few years, it was very difficult to be as light sounding as I was. And so I kind of made up for it by bravado and kind of swaggering around thinking I could be, you know, like Etta James in a minute.
You know, when you started on the road and you were opening for a lot of older blues performers, you said that you had to kind of care for the alcohol for them, make sure they drank enough to get on stage, but not too much.
yeah, that was an interesting position to be in. I'm sorry I cut you off, Terry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask you about that period and what it was like to realize that with some of the musicians they needed to drink, but you had to make sure they didn't drink too much.
Oh, that was just, yeah, there was one blues festival where it was kind of my job to, because there was a lot of different blues men in one backstage area, all of whom had not only different tastes in what to drink, but could handle it differently. For example, Sunhouse, if he had a couple of shots of vodka, he could remember all of his songs, and if he had too much, he couldn't remember them. So if he didn't have any at all, he usually didn't even want to play. So it was just one of these chemistry experiments that was kind of a funny anecdote for a young college student hanging out with these blues guys, because it was kind of my job to help road manage, and I had to be sure not to let somebody pass a pint bottle to somebody that I knew was just going to get totally toasted, and he didn't play until 4 hours from now. You know, you're getting old guys that have been farmers and Pullman porters for 25 years, and suddenly everybody wants to give them anything they want in whatever quantity, and it did a lot of them in. You know, you have to be really careful, otherwise it's not helping anybody to give somebody who has a propensity to alcoholism too much alcohol, and we've all seen that and every lifestyle in rock and roll.
My guest is Bonnie Raitt. Her latest CD is called Road Tested. We'll talk more and hear more music after a break. This is Fresh Air. Bonnie Raitt is my guest, and we've asked her to bring with her some of the records that have influenced her over the years. And Bonnie Raitt, the next record you brought with you is by Sippy Wallace, and your fans all know that you've recorded a couple of her songs, You Gotta Know How, Women Be Wise. Tell us about the record you've brought with you and why you've chosen it.
Well, this particular album, which has now been re-released on Alligator Records, it's from an album called, I think it's Sippy Sings the Blues, if they left the name the same. And I picked it up when I was 18. I spent the summer, my freshman year, in on a charter college charter flight and traveled around Europe with a couple of girlfriends. Went into the famous Dobell's record store in London and found this incredible picture of this woman in these rhinestone cat glasses, and it said Sippy Wallace. And I recognized the name from my old classic blues collection records, you know, compilations. And I'd always really liked Sippy's music because she really didn't take any slack. You know, she didn't cut anybody any slack in terms of men at the time. She wasn't a victim. She was, you know, you can make me do what you want to do, but you got to know how. And so I had bought the record, fell in love with her, had no idea she was still alive. And at that point, the record was only 2 or 3 years old, I think. And I recorded a couple of her songs, three actually, over my first two albums. And when I was invited to come to the Ann Arbor Blues and Jazz Festival in 1972 to perform, I, at that point, had found out that that's where she was living, in Detroit, and invited her to come out on stage. She said she would only do gospel because she was recovering from a stroke and had given up the blues and was playing in the church. And so I started playing Women Be Wise in the little trailer backstage, and she started kind of sashaying back and forth, and she said, well, maybe I'll just do one blues, you know. And the rest is kind of history, because after that, she was the big hit of the festival, our duet of this song, and we went on to record it together in her subsequent album, Sippy, on Atlantic Records. And we toured together for the next 15 years till she passed away at 86.
Well, why don't we hear that 1966 recording that you brought with you. This is re-released on Alligator Records. Sippy Wallace.
Now, women be wise. Keep your mouth shut. Don't advertise your man. Don't ever sit around gossiping, explaining what your good man really can do. Now these women nowadays, they ain't no good. They laugh in your face, then try to steal your man from you. Now women be wise, keep your mouth shut, and don't advertise your man. Don't be no fool, don't advertise.
Man, oh man.
That's a wonderful
That's
recording.
Really, really great. Yeah. It just makes me smile so much to hear this again.
Did Sippy Wallace give you any interesting advice about life or music?
Well, I'd say those lyrics, for starters, I mean, both You Got to Know How and Women Be Wise and Mighty Tight Woman, they're all these tunes that she writes are real lessons, you know, and I learned a lot about what kind of songs appeal to me by what she chose to write about. And, yeah, I mean, just in terms of her love of family and her independence from men, I mean, she lost her husband many years previous to when I met her and seemed to have a very full life not being somebody's wife. I'm sure she would have, you know, she missed her husband. He was the love of her life, and she really had no desire to get connected again. And that was a very strong lesson to me as a young girl. She was a great... you know, she had some grandnieces, you know, that she took care of, and she raised them by herself, and was just very strong, very independent, and ahead of her time in terms of her just being suspicious and distrustful unless you were proven to be somebody that was worth hanging out with. And that's something that was very important to me, because I did grow up in a feminist era, and to have a blues woman or someone like Ruth Brown or Aretha Franklin as my role models, as well as Joan Baez and Joni Mitchell. You know, these are women that just stood up for themselves and demanded respect.
Bonnie Raitt is my guest, and we've asked her to bring with her some of her favorite recordings from the past, recordings that have really influenced her over the years. And Bonnie Raitt, the next recording that you brought with you is B.B. King, and this one goes back to 1958. Rock Me Baby. Tell me why you chose this one.
Well, this is one of the greatest vocals I've ever heard. And so simple, and the piano part and the arrangement. This is really early in, even though B.B. started in the late 40s, and it's got a lot of his hits in the 50s, this was a record when I was 10 or 11 years old, I happened to hear on a radio station, and later just was my, everybody's got that one record that just turned their head around. I mean, sometimes there's a Ray Charles tune that did it for me, and then later hearing John Lee Hooker when I was about 14. But B.B. King was a big star in Los Angeles on the black radio, and Rock Me Baby's just a classic tune. I mean, many people have covered it, but I just wanted to bring it to let you know how unbelievably simple and pure and right to the bone this song can be. And B.B.'s still one of our greatest bluesmen, and I love him dearly.
Let's hear it. Rock Me Baby, B.B. King, recorded in 1958 and reissued on the B.B. King box set.
Rock me, baby, rock me all night long.
Bonnie Raitt, do you think that there's a specific influence B.B. King has had on your singing or guitar playing?
Well, I sure hope so. I don't know how to play single-string lead on an electric guitar as well as any of the guitar players that are currently out there. I play acoustic solos more, and I play pretty good rhythm guitar, but my lead playing tends to remain on the slide guitar where I know what I'm doing better. So I just, it probably has more to do with phrasing and what to leave out, and just, you know, when you go crazy for somebody's style, it's not, unless you're doing a specific mimicking of what they're doing, which I don't do, it's just hard to say. It would be for the outsider to say, I think she was influenced by this person more than that person. But for me, I would say my singing, just because of his restraint and his passion, I hope I got some influence from him, because I just think he's one of the tastiest and most deep singers I've ever heard, as well as one of the greatest blues guitar players alive in the history of guitar players.
Bonnie Raitt, her latest album is called Road Tested. She'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Bonnie Raitt talks about collaborating with her father, John Raitt, singing the Broadway show tunes that he made famous. And John Raitt talks about his early days in theater.
Rumors fly and you don't know where they start, especially when it concerns a person's heart. I've heard tales that would set my heart aglow. Wish I knew if the things I've heard were so.
Mm-hmm.
They say that falling in love is wonderful. It's wonderful, so they say. And with the moon up above, it's wonderful. It's wonderful, so they tell me. I can't recall who said it. I know I never read it. I only know they tell me that love is grand. And this thing that's known as romance.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Back with more of our interview with Bonnie Raitt. She's famous for her blues-influenced singing and guitar playing, but the music she was born into didn't come from the Delta, it came from Broadway. Her father, John Raitt, was one of the most famous Broadway-leading men of his generation. We'll hear from him a little later. Bonnie Raitt told me she didn't feel comfortable performing show tunes until later in her career.
It took a long time to summon up the nerve, and I think, somewhat of maturity and sobriety had something to do with it. What comes with sobriety in terms of being able to have a perspective. And since that coincided with, my late 30s, early 40s for me, it's hard to separate the two. I think that a great song has appealed to me, and I've been in love with the songs of Carousel in Oklahoma and Pajama Game since my dad has been singing them all my life. I just never really thought I would sing them in public. I certainly sung them enough in private just for fun and grew up singing them. We started this idea out when we used to just practice Christmas carols and would sing different Broadway songs in his pool. We'd be exercising together, and that was a good way to spend some father-daughter alone time. And next thing I knew, he sort of suggested doing something together, maybe for the Pops. And before we knew it, we were performing with John Williams for Evening at the Pops a few years ago, and we did these songs that we ended up putting on my dad's album. And I enjoyed it so much and was terrified to sing in front of an orchestra in a town in Boston that is like I still got my start in. And I think the fact that it was a safe ground made it an easy first date.
As we can tell from the records you've brought with you today, you really like to acknowledge your debt to your predecessors in blues. And you've done that not only through recording their songs, but for the people who were alive, you really did your best to call attention to them and introduce them to your listeners when you became popular. And now you're very active in something called the Rhythm and Blues Foundation. Tell us a little bit about the goals of the foundation and why that's so important to you.
The R&B Foundation is a group of us that were very concerned about the lack of royalty payments and fairness from rhythm and blues artists. And it was founded about 7 years ago in Washington, D.C., by a lawyer named Howell Beagle, who had basically gone to Atlantic Records to try to get clarification on some royalty statements for about 35 of the great R&B artists, like Ruth Brown and the Clovers, different acts. And it came to pass that all of us were horrified to find out that people before 1970 basically did not get our current 10% standard royalty rate, but something very little, if a royalty at all, and out of which they were supposed to pay the entire cost of every album. And so we have all these great rhythm and blues artists, and it's also country acts and pop acts as well, who did not participate in their own profits and therefore didn't belong to the union all this time, didn't get union coverage, and don't have any health benefits. So the foundation was formed with an endowment out of which we give Pioneer Awards every year, which is, 20,000 to 8 or 9 different wonderful pioneers of rhythm and blues, and 4 groups that split 20,000. And we give a Lifetime Achievement Award. We've had 7 annual Pioneer Awards, and this year Bo Diddley is receiving the Lifetime Achievement Award. And we've honored over 100 different recipients, but the basic thrust of the organization is to get royalty reform from different record companies, to ask them to wipe out the past debts, and if you're going to sell records today and CDs by these artists, give them the standard rate. And in the 7 years, we've managed to get that from EMI, from Atlantic Records. We're working on Warner Brothers, working on MCA has agreed to come around, and PolyGram is still a holdout, and Sony has just last year agreed to come on board. So basically we're trying to get financial and medical assistance and eventually get some health insurance, because this is not an issue of charity. This is an issue of justice and money that they should have been making all this time, but the contracts of the day just weren't that fair.
So the main purpose of the Rhythm and Blues Foundation is to help artists get royalties that they're owed, and also help them with health benefits and with money if they've been deprived of royalties.
And we're also trying to get some performance opportunities. You know, it's like things like having...
To revive careers.
Yeah, and like, you know, there's a lot of cities that have blues festivals now, but what about if the, you know, the assemblies in this... I was talking to somebody the other day that said that this black jazz musician went into a predominantly urban Latino and black high school the other day at an assembly and was talking, giving a lecture, and he asked the kids, how many of you have heard of Duke Ellington? And one kid out of 200 raised his hand. So, you know, the fact that these artists could be going into the schools and giving performances and letting especially young black kids know where this music comes from, because, you know, Prince is not the godfather of soul, you know what I mean? And we got to do something to change that, because there would be no Eric Clapton or Rod Stewart or Bonnie Raitt or Stevie Ray Vaughan without the artists that started this, and they didn't get what was due for them.
Well, I want to end with something from your road-tested album, and this is I Can't Make You Love Me. It's a really beautiful ballad, very moving. Is this a favorite of yours, too?
Yeah, I'd have to say that of all the tunes I've recorded, this one moves me the most, and it's the one that gets mentioned to me when I'm out and about, and, you know, sky caps or people that are taking my reservation on the phone, you know, they just have spoken to me about how much that song means, and I just have to thank Mike Reed and Alan Shamlin for feeling as deeply as they did to come up with this, because I definitely think this is one that's going to stand the test of time.
Turn down the lights, turn down the bed, turn down these voices inside my head. Lay down with me and tell me no lies, just hold me close. Don't patronize, don't patronize me, 'cause I can make you love me if you don't. You can make your heart feel something it won't.
Bonnie Raitt with Bruce Hornsby at the piano from her live double CD, Road Tested. We'll hear from Bonnie Raitt's father, John Raitt, after a break. This is Fresh Air. Many people who came of age in the years before rock and roll are more likely to know John Raitt than his daughter Bonnie. 50 years ago, John Raitt launched his Broadway career, originating the role of Billy Bigelow in Carousel. Some people consider him his era's quintessential musical leading man. He starred in the original production of Pajama Game, starred with Mary Martin in a TV production of Annie Get Your Gun. He toured the country in such musicals as Oklahoma, The Most Happy Fella, South Pacific, and Kismet. A recent CD called The Best of John Raitt collects some of his early recordings. He also recently made his first new recording in 25 years. His daughter Bonnie Raitt joined him on several tracks. Here they are singing a song from Annie Get Your Gun.
Anything you can do, I can do better. I can do anything better than you.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
Anything you can be, I can be greater. Sooner or later, I'm greater than you.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am. Yes, I am. I can shoot a partridge with a single cartridge.
I can get a sparrow with a bow and arrow.
I can live on bread and cheese.
And only on that?
Yeah.
So can a rat. Anything you can buy.
John Raitt, welcome to Fresh Air.
It's a pleasure to be on this lovely show.
Oh, thank you. Tell me how you and your daughter Bonnie Raitt decided to make this album together.
Well, it came by a long period. It took me about 2 years to convince Bonnie that it was her idea for us to do the Boston Pops. She says, Dad, I can't sing with a, 85-piece orchestra. I just used to sing with my 6-piece band that I have. And then it sort of worked on. We finally convinced her to do the Boston Pops. And then she brought me last year to Radio City Music Hall as a guest on the show that she was doing. And then I think what happened with this album was that she had finished up her European tour in Dublin. And on her way home, she sat next to Steve Murphy, who was the president of Angel Records, a subsidiary of both Capitol Records, which Bonnie signed for, and EMI, of course. And I think that's where it started, because she says, Dad and I have been doing some duets together, and I started to feel a little confidence in singing Broadway show songs, which is Dad's forte. And maybe we should do an album. You should certainly record him because he's still singing pretty well. And so this is the first album I made in 25 years.
Wow. Now, since she's performed your material with you and you've sang a little bit of her material with her, what kind of advice have you given each other on how to do each other's songs?
Well, I basically said we are storytellers. And it's the best way you tell a story is whatever, if you need to speak the lines or sing the lines. And she didn't realize, I don't think, that she had such a good, legitimate soprano voice. And I knew it all the time. And she has blossomed so that it's just a tremendous gratification to me to be able to sing with her just as a singer. I mean, she sounds a lot like Mary Martin, as you can tell even in the song that we just played. And it's just been a great joy for me to be able to. I'm not conscious in some ways when we get going that the father and daughter bit. I just, is another great performer that I'm singing with.
Now, has she given you any advice about how to sound when you're performing with her on her songs?
Yeah, she told me a little bit on some of the things because it's a different style of singing, but it's good.
So what'd she tell you?
Well, just have to loosen up a little bit, have a little more feeling for the song.
So do you use a different voice when you sing with her on her
songs? No, I only sing with one voice, and that's what I've got. I don't think you have to make that change. The style a little bit, possibly, is a little looser, but even that doesn't change because, they're all songs. And as you interpret it in your own way, you don't try to copy anybody.
Now, John Raitt, you sang opera before going to Broadway.
Well, sort
yes?
of. I was luckily in California. We had a group called American Music Theater, and we were doing operas in English. And that gave me great training to do the Broadway shows, especially Carousel, which is now our 50th year anniversary of it. And I think Rodgers and Hammerstein wrote the soliloquy because they had heard me sing the Figaro aria for the Barber of Seville. And they knew that I had this operatic upper register especially, and it's certainly evident in the soliloquy. I call it a one-act opera anyway when I sing it.
Now, where did they hear you sing?
I came to audition. So being very cocky in those days, I thought I would dazzle them at the audition by singing the Figueroa for the Barber Seville. And that did it. And that prompted the writing of this wonderful legacy that Rodgers and Hammerstein left for me in Carousel.
Now, if I'm familiar with John Raitt lore, I think the way the story goes is that you were actually auditioning for Oklahoma.
I was. I was brought on to take over the lead of Alfred Drake, and they decided I might be a good bet for their new musical adaptation of Frank Molnar's Lilium, and shipped me off to Chicago, where I got my feet wet, so to speak, and played for about 10 months in that show before they brought me right in to do Carousel.
So you were doing the Road Company of Oklahoma mm-hmm. while Rodgers and Hammerstein were
right.
writing Carousel, and they wrote the soliloquy for you, also known as My Boy Bill. Why don't we hear it?
My boy Bill, I will see that he's named after me. I will. My boy Bill, he'll be tall and as tough as a tree. Will Bill, like a tree, he'll grow with his head held high and his feet planted firm on the ground. And you won't see nobody dare to try boss him or toss him around. No pot-bellied, baggy-eyed bully will boss him around.
John Raitt from the original cast recording of Carousel. I believe you were singing the role of Billy Bigelow, you know, on the road or in summer stock, even into your 60s. Did it ever get to feel like, well, I'm really too old for this part?
Well, I think I felt, because I've had some arthritic problems, and I was having trouble with my left hip. And when I see the tape, we did amateur tape, of course, I was a little bit set back by the fact that I wasn't as agile and as young-looking as I had hoped to feel that I am. You know, we feel inside that we're just the same, but then you look yourself in the mirror and you say, hey, buddy, you're getting along there, you know.
Now, in the film versions of Carousel in Oklahoma, the parts that you had played went to Gordon McRae. Did you resent him?
No, I helped Gordon get the part, as a matter of fact, because I was doing Pajama Game, and back in those days, you know, they want a John Raitt type and not John Raitt. And since Gordon had done Oklahoma with Shirley Jones, they thought it would be great to have the team do Carousel as well.
Now, you did the Broadway and film versions of Pajama Game.
Yeah, I was very fortunate because my big competitor all through the years, Howard Keel, had done Calamity Jane with Doris Day and very much contention to do it. But George Abbott wanted as many of the original people as he could. And when Jack Warner was able to get a star of the magnitude of Doris Day, then he said, you can have all the rest of your people, you know.
Now, why don't I play Hey There, which I think is the loveliest song from Pajama Game.
Okay. Which one you want to play?
Which one would you like to hear? We have the original, and we have the one that you
recorded
as duet.
I want you to do with Bonnie. I think it's kind of fun to have the people hear
okay.
what daughter can do with one of Dad's songs.
Okay, so here we go. This is John Raitt and Bonnie Raitt singing Hey There from Pajama Game.
Hey there, you with the stars in your eyes. Love never made a fool of you. You used to be too wise. Hey there, you on that high flying cloud. Though she won't throw a crumb to you, you think someday she'll come to you. Better forget her.
Forget her.
Her with her nose in the air.
With her nose in the
she
air.
She has you dancing on a string.
A puppet on a string.
Break it and she won't care.
She won't care for
won't
me. Like a brother, or am I not seeing things too clear?
Are you too much in love to hear?
Is it all going in one ear? And out the other?
What's the longest run you did on Broadway?
Pajama Game, 1,060 performances.
How many years is that?
That's 2.5 years. And I missed about one performance. I would hope to say I could do, I had done them all, but I didn't. I had one week on a Wednesday. I had such a bad cold that the doctor told me if I did both the shows that day, I'd be out the rest of the week. But if I didn't do the matinee, he could probably get me through the week.
My guest is John Raitt. We'll talk more in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Back with singer John Raitt. A recent CD called The Best of John Raitt collects some of his early recordings. He also recently made his first new recording in 25 years called Broadway Legend, which includes duets with his daughter, Bonnie Raitt. Do you do exercises to keep your voice in shape?
No, because I'm a natural singer. I just have to go from right what I'm talking to you now. It's, oh, what a beautiful morning. It's right there, you know, so there's no problem.
So your singing range is the same as your speaking range, and you could go right into
right,
it.
Right, because I'm a high lyric baritone, which is the most flexible of all the voices for Broadway musicals. I have a long range. I have a big upper register, which helped me a lot with these big long songs. Like in the soliloquy, for instance, you start off down below and you finish up in an operatic aria, finish to speak, and not only do you have to have the stamina, but you have to have your knowledge about you, what you can do.
Have you lost any of your range?
A little bit, I think, on the top. I used to have it amazing. I could sing high C's, and baritones are not supposed to sing high C's, you know. But I think I possibly still could some, but I've noticed it a little bit up on the top.
Now, I think it was about, would you say, 14 years ago that you married the woman who had actually been your childhood sweetheart?
Yeah, Rosemary Kramer was her name, and she was Scotch. No, I was Scotch. She was a Spanish land-grant Catholic in the area in Orange County. In fact, her family goes back to 1769. She's eighth generation Californian and only child. And she had one of those mothers that had bigger aspirations for her son-in-law than a guy at that time was going to be an athletic instructor or a coach. So they separated. I was Scotch Presbyterian, so they separated on the religious grounds. And today, you, of course, wouldn't listen to it. We just take off.
So they refused to let you get married?
Yeah. 41 years later, we finally, after her second marriage, after my second marriage, fortunately, we were both free and available, and it was a marvelous experience, and we've been having a great time making up for it for 14 years.
Had you kept in touch over the years?
No. The only time I saw her, I came back as a local boy makes good after Carousel to do a concert in Fullerton, California, in Orange County. And in the reception line was Rosemary and her mother. And her mother was one of these beautiful ladies that with the long eyelashes and the blue eyeshadow. She took me aside at the reception and said, "We made a mistake. You were always our favorite."
You know? Oh, yeah, sure. Too late for that.
That's right.
So
the only time I saw her in the 41 years.
You weren't going to be good enough. You weren't going to be good enough professionally. If you don't mind my asking, what did your wife's first husband do professionally?
He was an attorney. She
well,
her mother picked out her husband for her.
Uh-huh.
She was in such a state of shock, we find, you know, because we had a really serious love affair. She would always come see me sing when I did. I did 8 shows for the Civic Light Opera out in Los Angeles, and she probably saw them all, but she said it was such a traumatic experience for her, she doesn't remember it too well.
So she would come and see you sing, but not tell you she was in the audience?
No. No, I didn't ever, I never, I called up when I got a telephone number, and this lovely voice answers, and I said, "This is your first love. This is 41 years later, right?" And she says, "Who is this?" Thinking I'm a nut, of course. And I told her, and she says, "Well, you're right. You were my first love." And then went over to pick her up because I invited her immediately for dinner. I was always strong with Rosemary, not too with the other two wives. And she stuck her head out the door and says, "What do you see to me?" And I said the best ad-lib line I ever gave on or off stage by saying, "I see the same eyes I saw 41 years ago." Hmm. Which is pretty romantic, I guess.
So did you ever ask yourself if you think the marriage would have stayed
well,
together?
Well, yeah, we talked about it a lot. And Bonnie's awful happy that we didn't get married, of course.
That's right. She wouldn't have been born. I guess things work out for the best.
I know. They work out, you know. We're still friendly with my two wives. My second wife is Kathy, still has the name, and she's the executive secretary for Jimmy Niederlander, the Niederlander Theaters. So whenever I need Broadway tickets, I call up Kathy and she gets tickets.
That sounds handy.
Yeah, why not?
Singer John Raitt. A recent CD called The Best of John Raitt collects some of his early recordings. His latest CD, Broadway Legend, includes duets with his daughter, Bonnie Raitt. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Roberta Sherrock produced today's show with Barbara Bogave. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with Bonnie Raitt's recording of the song Baby Mine from the Disney movie Dumbo. Have a good holiday.
Baby mine, don't you cry. Baby mine, dry your eyes. Rest your head close to my heart, never to part, baby of mine. Little one, when you play, let those eyes sparkle and shine, never a tear, baby of mine. And if they knew, sweet little you, they'd end up loving.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the Scatolites, the group that virtually created ska and is now at the forefront of the ska revival.
Ska is a Jamaican music which predates reggae. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.